I'm sorry, you ready to jump on back in?
I am ready. Let's go. Let's go, girls. Drive the highway down the moon. Past the billboard where you see me.
Welcome back to the Silver Nitrate Witches Movie Review Brew, the podcast where we talk about how we talk about movies. And we are your Silver Nitrate Witches. I'm Isabel Lang. I'm a poet, academic editor, and tarot reader.
And I'm Laura Valenza. I'm co-film editor at the Brooklyn Rail, and I recently gave a TEDx talk about gender and film criticism.
And hopefully that's a movie that we get to talk about again on this podcast, what you talked about in your TED Talk, because that was a great time.
Oh, yes. But I'm a Cheerleader was the main focus of the discussion.
All right. So today, before we get into any details, I just want to start us off. The film we're going to be talking about, just as a content warning, does depict suicidal ideation, self-harm, that sort of thing. So if that is something that's going to be a tough listen for you today, you know, just take care while you are listening, or perhaps give this episode a pass, and we'll see you next time.
And we have many other fabulous episodes that you can check out too.
Yes, on any podcast platform near you, you can go ahead and just re-listen to the whole first season instead, and then come back next week. Okay, so today we are talking about, and continuing our theme on education, one of my favorite movies about education, I think a lot of people's favorite movies about schooling and education, which is Dead Poets Society. So this film was released on June 2nd, 1989, so like a weirdly a little topical, you know, we're in June, I'm not going to do the math, but it's something's anniversary recently, right? This film was written by Tom Schulman and directed by Peter Weir, who also directed The Truman Show, which we talked about last week.
Okay, I saw his name in the credits in the beginning, and I was like, that name sounds so familiar. Yes.
The writer, Tom Schulman, won the Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay for this film. It was nominated for a bunch of awards. I believe that's the only one it won. And the screenplay he wrote was apparently also semi-autobiographical. Apparently the Mr. Keating, the teacher character, was inspired by one of his own teachers from his high school experience. And that's what inspired him to write this story. Fun random facts. He also co-wrote Honey, I Shrunk the Kids the same year.
I loved that movie as a child.
Right? And another random but neat fact, he was formerly the president of the Writers Guild of America and was actually recently on the negotiation committee for the writer strikes in 2023. So thank you, Tom Schulman. So, Dead Poets Society. When it was being made, the budget that it had originally was $16.4 million. At the box office, it made $235.9 million worldwide. It stars, of course, the man we all recognize, Robin Williams, as John Keating, the English teacher. Also, Ethan Hawke as Todd Anderson. Did you get flashbacks to Ethan Hawke at the Garden Theater, Laura, watching this movie?
Yes, I was going to tell my Ethan Hawke story. And also, it took me forever. I had to look it up who he was in it because he's so young.
I couldn't actually figure out
which one he was at first.
We'll look at an article later that interviews him about this experience. He was so young, he was fairly new to the industry. I don't think this was his first movie, but like it was really early on in his career, and he does a phenomenal job. But so Ethan Hawke as Todd Anderson, and the lovely, wonderful, and seriously underappreciated Robert Sean Leonard as Neil Perry.
Wait, do you want to hear my Ethan Hawke story?
Well, hang on. Let me finish talking about Robert John Leonard, and then we'll talk about Ethan Hawke, because okay. I want to talk about Robert John Leonard for a minute, because this man is fucking amazing, and we don't love him and appreciate him as much as we should.
Wait, can you remind me? So, there are a lot of very waspy teenage boys
yes.
with the same haircut wearing uniforms, so who is who?
These are the main two. They are the roommates. We'll talk about them in the plot later, but these are, like, the new kid who gets introduced at the top of the film. That's Todd. His roommate that he is immediately introduced to, whose father wants him to be a doctor and cut back on his extracurriculars. That is Neil. Does that
and
help you?
And his father is really scary.
His father is Red from the 70s show.
Oh my god! That's who that was! This whole movie, I'm like, why do I know that face?
I can't take it seriously, because I'm like, I know you, old man, you're full of shit! Anyway, but those are those two characters. There's a host of other young boys that take place. We'll talk about how this movie is really a good ensemble piece as well later on. But Robert Sean Leonard, most of us will probably recognize him from House. He plays Dr. Wilson in that show. And my favorite thing that he has ever been in, if you have never seen it, you absolutely should watch it. The Much Ado About Nothing film with Emma Thompson and Kenneth Branagh and Keanu Reeves, who I forget is in that until I think about it.
Well, that was a hard left. I don't actually know that one.
It's, oh, Laura, it's so good. I think you would really love it. It's great. I forget the name of the character, but he plays the character that is Hero's love interest. In the story, the younger sister's love interest. And he's just,
right.
He's just like a little...
Orlando? Orsino?
Those both sound slightly correct. He's just this like lovely little like love-struck puppy throughout the whole thing. He's so adorable. He's underrated. He's amazing. He did a lot of theater work. He's great. If you've never seen him in anything other than House, you should watch Dead Poets Society and Much Ado About Nothing. Laura, will you tell us your Ethan Hawke story?
Oh my god, yes. Okay, so when I graduated from college, I got a job in Princeton, New Jersey at the Princeton University Art Museum, and I started spending all of my time after work going to the local independent movie theater in town, which was called the Garden Theater. And so when they were hiring for new staff, I applied for the job so that way I would not keep spending my paycheck there and I could go see all the movies I wanted for free that my schedule permitted. And anyway, in this whole process of getting very familiar with the Garden Theater, we had this opening, kind of like if you go to AMC and you see the Nicole Kidman opening where she has her sparkly suit and she talks about how movies are magic. So our Nicole Kidman was Ethan Hawke, because Ethan Hawke actually went to a preparatory school in the Princeton area, and he grew up going to the Garden Theater, and he came for an event for a movie he was doing that predate my time at the Garden Theater. And while he was there, the staff recorded him talking about his love of the theater. And he said, "This is the best theater in the whole world." And we're all very proud of that. And so because we were so proud of having somebody like Ethan Hawke come to our little theater and call it the best theater in the world, we would play that before every single showing. But the Garden Theater had a lot of people like me who were regular repeat customers, and we were all locals. And after about a year of showing Ethan Hawke saying, "This is the best theater in the world," again and again, everybody in the audience would groan. And by that point, I was working there, and we would actually have to deal with people coming up to us.
And complaining?
Yes, and being like, "Can you please change that? How much longer are we going to have to listen to Ethan Hawke?"
He's just so excited.
He's so excited, and he's so endearing, and it's actually a really great little clip, but everybody was like, we all have his little spiel memorized at this point. We have had to watch it before every movie for like an entire year.
Oh my god. Does it still play? Do you know?
I do not. I do not know, actually.
You'll have to go for a visit and find out sometime.
I think they found some other impressive guest to pin down and have record something about the Garden Theater.
Ethan Hawke. All right.
Yeah.
So that's the experience of Ethan Hawke Laura is bringing to the table today.
I know, it's so valuable to this story.
Yeah. So, while Ethan Hawke did attend a preparatory school in New Jersey, the film was not shot there. It was shot in Delaware. And apparently, this was the first feature film ever to be shot in Delaware.
But there's no sales tax.
So setting us in history, some other things that are going on in 1989, other movies that were released that year we might know are ones such as Twister, When Harry Met Sally, Weekend at Bernie's, one of my personal favorites, Field of Dreams, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, Ghostbusters 2, and Christmas Vacation.
Well, what a slate for that year.
Yeah. Yeah. And then things going on in the news at the time, just to kind of set us in where we are at the time of the movie being made.
Oh, wait, yeah. One question, actually. Uh-huh. Is this film is supposed to be, like, contemporaneous, right? Like, it was made in the 80s and it's set in the 80s?
No, we'll talk about that.
Okay, because there's, it's hard to tell at prep schools because they all kind of look a little anachronistic.
My first very, like, the first bullet point I have and just the notes I was taking as I watched it was, yeesh, I forgot how culty this school is.
Yeah. That was my first thought, too. I was like, this place is like a freaking cult.
Yeah, and I, for context, I have none of this written into my notes, but I'm sure at some point I'll bring up, well, when I was in boarding school, because I went to a boarding school, and every time I watch this movie, I'm like, this is not at all.
And also, for context, boarding school and preparatory school are, like, my worst nightmares. Like, the concept terrifies me.
This is not the kind of boarding school I went to, and so to watch this, I'm like, thank God. Because, like, we'll talk about the plot in a minute, but just other things going on in the news at the time that the movie was being released. I don't know if this is super necessary. I think it's interesting. Revolutions of 1989 were happening, so that's, like, the beginning of the end of the Soviet Union is going on. The very famous student protests in Beijing were happening. This was also the year that the first commercial internet providers became a thing. So, like, this is... We're at, like, the end of kind of this weird era, literally because it's 89 going into 90. We're at the beginning of this weird new technological era. There's a lot of, you know, civil unrest going on in different parts of the world. And I just think that's an interesting backdrop for this movie to emerge.
So there's a scene in the movie where the boys are trying to make their own radio because I guess they're not allowed to have radios, which seems... like a barbaric rule.
This is a culty school.
It's a culty school. But they finally get the radio to work, and it sounds like a 60s pop song on the radio.
So, set in a fictional all-boys boarding school / prep school in 1959.
Mm-hmm.
This film starts off, we're going into the plot now, if you couldn't tell. This film starts off with us meeting Todd, Ethan Hawke. He's a new student to the Welton Academy, which is jokingly called Helton by their students. This is a thing that we definitely did in my boarding school. Our school was the Louisiana School for Math, Science, and the Arts. A lot of people would joke as they went into it that it was called the Louisiana School for Marijuana, Sex, and Alcohol. It was not. At least not my experience of it, but...
When I met Belle, I thought the name was too long to remember, so I just called it the Louisiana School of Magic.
Yeah, my dad used to call it Hogwarts.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like Hogwarts when you describe it.
So, Ethan, not Ethan Hawke, sorry, Todd, the character, he is just joining the school as a junior. He meets his roommate in the beginning, who is this, you know, also a junior, this kind of star student who would, I would argue, is kind of a popular guy, which is Neil, played by Robert Sean Leonard.
Popular but kind.
Popular but kind.
He wants to include everyone.
So he meets Neil and all of his friends and is pretty immediately welcomed into their circle. Generally, this is the good bunch of guys, and I think that's really nice.
Yeah, and I think the other thing, too, about Todd is, like, he's really shy. So I definitely had some anxiety watching this movie, and this was my very first time ever watching Dead Poets, where I was like,
really?
Oh, no, are all these boys... Yeah. Oh, my God. I went through so many tissues and sobbed a lot. I think it's a really nice group of guys, but I definitely had anxiety about after the culty intro to the school that they were all going to gang up on this poor kid who's new and he seems really shy. And we already know that he has lots of pressure to be successful here because his brother was like valedictorian. And so he's very primed to be the kid that gets picked on, and they're just all so immediately welcoming to him, which is really sweet. Hello, Gus.
Our producer has joined us. It is a really sweet, immediate welcoming into the group. And as Laura was describing earlier, we do have a bunch of very similar looking, waspy, white prep school boys.
That all have the same light brown hair in the same haircut.
Except
and then they're
for...
all wearing school uniform. Oh, except for future Nazi.
Cameron is that guy's name, the one, the kid who turns on everybody? Is that who you mean?
Yeah, the redhead.
Yeah, and he's red. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Okay.
Mr. Well, I was just doing my job. That's what he's going to say someday.
Yeah. So, yeah, you already caught exactly what I was going to say next. So he's pretty immediately welcomed into their circle of friends, which is good because Todd's a very obviously shy and nervous kid. We also learn at the top of the movie that there is a new faculty member.
Can I also just point out, it's very important that Todd is shy because the main theme of this movie is definitely about knowing when you need to speak up and use your voice.
Yes.
So I think that's also, this is really important that that's established early in the movie.
We also learn at the top of the movie that there is a new faculty member, a Welcome alum himself, John Keating, played by Robin Williams, the new English lit teacher. In the first days of his classes, he establishes himself as the not-your-average Welton teacher with his alternative teaching methods, including ripping out the entire introduction chapter of their poetry book and calling it excrement. That's a good scene. I always love that.
It was stupid.
It was stupid. If you've never seen the movie, like, that is such a good scene where it's the chapter basically breaks the... reading of poetry down to like a mathematical formula, which is an interesting way to look at it, but like not at all a successful way to do it.
No, and it basically is like, therefore Shakespeare is more important than Byron, and it's kind of like, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, that seems subjective, but sure.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so throughout the movie, his focus as an educator, as Laura said, already is to teach kids, his students, how to use their voice, how to live, how to think, how to question things for themselves. And through the process, he even sneaks an old poetry collection into Neil and Todd's room that encourages the boys to restart the Dead Poets Society. Sorry, we had to pause for the cat to cross in front of the screen.
Oh, I thought we were pausing because we said the name.
We said the name! No. So he encourages them to restart their secret club, the Dead Poets Society, where they just kind of hang out in an off-campus cave late at night and read poetry. But ultimately, what they end up doing...
Well, no, Belle, they're practicing to make women swoon.
Right. Why do they swoon? I love...
Yes! I wrote that line down because I was like, that is my favorite line this whole movie, when the one kid goes, but why do they swoon?
I think outside of the Neil and Todd, like, immediate storyline, Knox is probably my favorite of those other characters.
Knox and Chris.
Knox and Chris.
The public school cheerleader.
Oh my god. And he's the one who is like, Charlie, why do they swoon? Like, he just doesn't get it. Yes. He's kind of discovering love for the first time.
Well... He does get it later when his poetry does actually work
Make
on
her
Chris.
Swoon, yes. So yeah, they read poetry, but ultimately they talk about life, they talk about love, they talk about dreams, fears, etc. Their goal, as they quote from Thoreau at the start of every meeting, is to suck the marrow out of life.
Beautiful symbolism, since this is about being brought together by an English class and literature. I think there's really beautiful symbolism of them meeting in the cave, but the cave is actually like, and it kind of becomes the metaphor of Plato's The Cave, where it's like, oh, they're in the ignorance of their very sheltered institution, and now they're passing through and out into the real world.
I love that. I never made that connection, but that is glorious.
It just occurred to me now that that could be a reading of that.
Especially the part where they're all kind of like, I forget what they're like, the last two lines of this one poem somebody read are like really rhythmic. Mm-hmm. And so they start like kind of drumming on stuff and chanting that last line of the poem as they all head out in a silly marching formation out of the cave. It's so good. Okay, so as they continue to meet as the Dead Poets Society, and also, you know, just as they continue to exist as teenagers with feelings and hormones and big dreams as teenagers do,
And the pressures of toxic masculinity.
And the pressures of toxic masculinity and tradition of Welton Academy. Mm-hmm. They get into various shenanigans, some more serious than others. We'll probably talk about a few of the others throughout the movie. We'll probably talk about a few of the others throughout our discussion. The big one that... becomes really prominent is that Neil discovers in himself an interest in acting, and he auditions and auditions for and stars in a local production of A Midsummer Night's Dream against the wishes of his father, who immediately removes him from school to send him to a military academy. Realizing his father is never going to see or understand Neil for himself, Neil commits suicide, prompting Welton to open a serious investigation into the Dead Poets Society, ultimately finding that they really can only lay the blame on Keating's bad influence on his students, which results in him being fired. And then at the end of the film, the Dead Poets Society members stand up, literally, they stand up on their desks for Keating, reciting the line, "Oh, Captain, my Captain," and it's the members of the Dead Poets Society, as well as a few other students who favored him as a teacher. One of my favorites is the kind of jock-looking guy whose poem was, "There was a cat, he sat on a mat." Like, he's one of the ones who stands up for him in the end, and I thought that was really great. So they stand up
for him. But not the future Nazi.
Not the future Nazi.
He does not stand up.
Cameron does not stand up. and anyway, and he leaves the classroom, like, vindicated. He's still fired, but he knows he's gotten through to these young men and that they're, you know, they're going to be on a better path of self-discovery despite the stuffy boarding school that they are stuck in. If you've never seen the movie, you've probably seen that scene, like, joked about in a number of different other movies or TV shows. I know for a fact there's, like, a Family Guy joke about that ending scene of the movie. If you've ever seen Dairy Girls, when they get the posh, cool literature teacher as a substitute, that's a reference to Dead Poets Society. Nine times out of ten, if you see a reference to, like, a really meaningful teacher in some kind of piece of modern media, it is probably a reference to Dead Poets Society.
I also, we do learn earlier in the movie that Robin Williams has a really cute girlfriend who's back in England, so I feel like there's
because he studied at Cambridge.
Yes, he's vindicated at the end, but you're also kind of like, it's going to be okay. He's going to go back to England and be reunited with his girlfriend. That's the story I tell myself about what happens after this movie.
I really don't ever think about, I don't ever think about what happens to him after the movie. I think a lot about what happens to the boys.
I think the boys are who, because I think you know that Keating knows who he is, mm-hmm. and you know that he's going to find a place where he's valued as an instructor. I was like, you should have just come to regular boarding school. We would have loved you. But whatever. I mean, regular public school would have loved you. I did not go to boarding school. It scares me.
He's a Rhodes Scholar, Laura. He can't just teach at a public school.
No, it's the who we're really concerned about is, does Todd learn how to speak up? And of course, at the end, he's the one.
He's the first one to stand up
on his desk and says, "Oh, Captain, my Captain." So we know that Todd has found. Well, Keating helped Todd find his voice in an earlier scene, but we know that Todd now also knows when to use his voice
for himself. Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
So that brings us very nicely into, like, before we dive into reviews and stuff, what are your, like, thoughts and feelings about, I did not know this was the first time you were going into it. I just assumed you hadn't seen it for a while. That seemed to me the way we were talking about it. So what were your thoughts diving in for the first ever time?
Yeah, I've never seen it, and I knew absolutely nothing about it.
I'm so sorry! I thought you knew, because, like, if I had, because Laura texted me earlier, and she's like, we probably need to have a content warning about the ending, and I was like, oh yeah, for sure, and then it occurred to me then, I was like, did she know that was going to happen in the end? And then I was like, should I have given her a content warning? I'm so sorry! I did tell you to buy Kleenex. In my defense.
I didn't know, but I figured it out almost as immediately as the movie started that that's where it was going, because I had told my dad a few days ago that I was like, oh, our next episode is going to be Dead Poets Society, and I was like, I think it's really sad, though, because Belle had asked me if it was going to be a weird shift, vibe shift from
Legally Blonde
to Dead Poets Society, and my dad was like, no, I mean, the ending's sad, but, and so I was like, okay, and so we were watching this movie, and I was like, one of these boys is not going to
is
be
not
going
to make it. No.
Yeah, and so I think I was kind of sitting there the whole movie, like, waiting for the other shoe to drop, and there's also a scene in the movie where, so we already talked about how it has very culty vibes. It definitely, like, is one of those classic gothic architecture type situations where it's America trying to pretend we have Oxford and Cambridge, even though we don't. And, you know, and it's all designed to produce boys who will go to the Ivy League, which is all supposed to look like Oxford and Cambridge, even though it's not. So it's a very scary, intimidating vibe. It's an all-boys school. It's kind of, it's not a military school. Neil is threatened that he's going to go to military school, mm-hmm. but there's something very militant about the level of discipline and hierarchy present at the school. Mm-hmm. So it's all designed to be very intimidating, but there's also one scene very early on where they're in some sort of study hall, and behind, I think, the headmaster, there's these glass display cases of guns in the school building. So
I don't know.
You kind of have this tip off early on that you know, the Chekhov thing that the gun has to go off. So it's kind of tipped off in the beginning that is where we eventually go. Those are not the guns that are used by Neil. Ultimately, he actually uses his father's, which I think is more poetic because it really is his father who drives him to do it.
Yeah.
But. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so anyway, I think it also, though, really got to me emotionally because it's been a really long time since I watched a Robin Williams movie.
Yes.
And if you were a little kid in the 90s, you probably grew up watching Robin Williams movies, and he was such a source of, like, joy and comfort in a sense that, you know, things will be okay and you can find good in the world, and then he took his own life.
Yeah.
When we got older. And I mean, I know that was a very tragic moment for a lot of people to lose mm-hmm. somebody who had such a positive influence on the world. And so I think there was sort of the double sensation of the sadness of what was happening in the movie, but also the sadness of kind of remembering, you know, losing such a great talent.
A bright light.
A bright light
in
a sometimes dark world.
Like the genie and Mrs. Doubtfire and the Birdcage. I had a weird childhood where that was a family movie of ours.
Other than that, though, there were also just some, like, really beautiful scenes.
Yes.
Like, the way in which scenes were paired or shots were paired that I thought was really interesting.
Okay, tell me.
Well, early on, there's this gorgeous... So they have all these moments whenever there's, like, a pause in the movie where they take a moment to, like, get those beautiful shots of, like, this ornate campus and the beautiful kind of countryside that it's in.
Yes, I know
my
favorite.
It's really beautiful. It's very, like... I mean, if you haven't seen this, but you've seen, like, the 2005 Pride and Prejudice, it's very, like, all those misty mornings in the field kind of vibe. But there's a great shot of this flock of birds.
Yes, that's exactly the one I was thinking of, where he rides his bike.
No, there's a lot of birds. In the very, very beginning, there's a flock of birds, and then it cuts to the flock of boys on the stairwell in the campus. And I thought that was really interesting. And then if you notice, I'll let you tell us about the other birds later, but I started noticing then throughout the movie that there were really interesting moments where birds appear. And there's a moment, too, when they first start the Dead Poets Society, that a bird, like, sort of jumps out of the bushes and, like, scares all of them, and it's kind of a jump scare for the audience, too. And so there's this interesting symbolism of birds that's beautiful, but there's also a little bit of terror there, and there's this real sense of, like, that flock mentality that Keating is really pushing against, where it's like, be a free thinker.
Yes.
And then there's another moment, too, kind of to the free thinking point, where they have this great scene that's all about Keating doing an exercise with the boys to help them realize how easy conformity is and how to be aware of that and to be a free thinker. And right after that scene, Neil has to cheer Todd up, I think, because Todd gets the same gift from his parents that he got for his birthday last year. And so I thought that was such a beautiful pairing of, like, the importance of free thinking, and then these parents. The parents are, like, very much villainized in this movie. The parents,
we'll talk about
who
parents.
Who can't even, like, think of an original gift. They don't even realize, like, that they're just repeating themselves. And then tell us about the other birds.
Before I tell you about the other birds, I want to talk more about the desk set. What I love now that you've linked the birds and the boys together is what makes, I think, that desk set scene even more beautiful is in an effort to cheer Todd up. Neil is talking about how great of a desk set is, and he's like, it's very aerodynamic if you think about it. I think this desk set wants to fly. And then they throw it off the bridge, and all the papers flutter around like birds.
Yes!
The bird scene I love is when Knox, who's in love with the public school girl Chris, decides to bike to the it starts off very creepy. I will say that.
Yes.
He kind of like creeps on her from afar for a while, and so he rides his bike to the public school to,
and
like, watch
her.
And
there's a moment where he tries to kiss her while she's unconscious at a party. I will say, though, I think a lot of this movie is also about growth and learning how
yes.
to be an ethical person. And there is a great moment where later he sees her and he does say, I was a jerk.
Yeah.
You know, and he says, I'm really sorry. He mm-hmm. he recognizes that his behavior was not appropriate and tries to make things right with Chris.
Yes. Yeah. But the first time...
her boyfriend, who sucks.
Chet Danbury.
I know, he has such a... jerky
they
name.
All I'm gonna be to be honest they all have pretty jerky names.
That's true. Knox Overstreet.
Knox Overstreet, Charlie Danver,
Dalton.
Yeah.
Dalton.
Richard Cameron. Anyway.
Yeah.
But no, he's riding his bike to go to the public school to see her, and he careens down this grassy hill into a flock of ducks or geese or whatever. And, you know, when you're riding your bike down the hill, the gravity does the work for you. So he takes his hands off the handlebars and he goes, woo! And as he's riding up to it, all the geese just take off in the waves of his bike wheels. And it's just, it's such a moment of pure joy. And I love it so much.
And it's sort of like the freedom, too.
Yes.
Like that, I think that comes back to the free thinking idea and, like, breaking away from the flock.
Mm-hmm. It's so good.
And I also wanted to bring up the other thing that I took notes about, and I feel like this is something that maybe, I don't know if you want to dive into too much now, because I have a feeling you're going to be like, that's going to come up more. But I also thought... because this is a movie that is, like, so male-dominated, because we are at a prep school, the gender dynamics and the idea of gender roles and, like, masculine expectations and toxic masculinity, I thought was really interesting in the movie. So that was something I found myself thinking about. And I think that really comes to a head when Neil takes his own life.
Yeah, absolutely. That's...
yeah.
That is not something that is super present in the reviews and the discourse around the time of its release, but that's absolutely something that I think is more recognized by viewers today, for sure. Well, for sure.
I think something that I would say then to that point that I think is maybe interesting to keep in mind while we talk about the movie is... I think whenever you have a prep school that's one gender, there's always going to be a certain level of, like, homoerotic undertones.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, right? Like,
Oh, yeah.
And then I thought something that was really interesting is that there's a lot of, I mean, like...
Neil and Todd forever. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, Neil and Todd forever. But there's also... I thought something that was so interesting is that it felt like the school was so determined to produce men that met the capitalist society ideal of masculinity. And so, therefore, any sort of breaking out of that almost felt like flirting with the feminine, and that's really what terrified the school, is this idea that gender was not as fixed as one would like. And...
I think that's especially because the thing that Neil finds his passion in is the arts.
Yes. Or the Dead Poets Society.
The Dead Poets. A bunch of boys reading poetry
read
in the woods.
Poetry.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think that... so that I thought was kind of like particularly interesting. But then I think that really comes to an interesting head when you get to Neil and his father in the scene that ultimately pushes Neil over the edge and leads to his death. There's this really, that you get the real, his mother is in the background of that scene. So you
literally
really get the highlight. Literally,
like,
in the background.
Like, just hiding on the chair in the background.
Yes. And she looks so sad for her son. And yet, she's been put in this position that she clearly feels she can't do anything about it. And the father is just so domineering and wants such, like, a traditional masculine provider path for his son. And there's this really aching moment where the father and the mother go to bed right before Neil steals his father's gun. And you can't see the mother anymore, but you hear her sob off screen. Mm-hmm. And as you're hearing her sob, the camera is on the father's slippers that he has to adjust so they are perfectly together and even next to his bed. And there's just something so painful about this clearly overly controlling man and this woman who is sobbing off camera. And then we know that that's the end for Neil. After that, we have that very intense crown of thorns Jesus moment
with Neil.
Yeah. Also, the scene right before that where he's playing Puck in Midsummer Night's Dream and he gives that monologue about, like, please forgive Puck, like, my intentions were good. Yeah.
If we creatures have offended, think but this and all is ended, all is mended, that you have but slumbered here while these...
And he's, like, watching his father in the back while he's delivering that scream. You know he's not...
Asking for the forgiveness.
Speech, you know... Yes, he's talking to his father, and that his father just can't hear him.
For me, it's the scene right in the middle of those two, where they're at their home, his father's giving him the talking to, the mother's in the background. Right after that, his father leaves, and his mother comes to him, and, like, she knows anything she could possibly do. Like, there's nothing she could do in this moment to fix anything. Anything she could try is going to be absolutely futile. And he's just standing there, kind of staring into the middle distance. And this is the part where I always first start to cry in the movie. When he's just standing there and staring off in the distance. And he says, I was good. I was really good. And in that moment, you would almost expect the motherly figure to say something like, you were great, you did a good job, it's gonna be okay, or something like that. And all she can do is say, go to bed. Like, she has no power to even give him comfort, except to tell him to get some rest. And it's just heartbreaking.
Yeah. I think the thing that was amazing is, like, there were a lot of tears for me at the end of that movie. I was amazed how early the tears started for me, because it was not Neil dies and then I start crying. Like, I definitely was crying well before that. Because there's also that scene where he lies to Keating and you can tell he's lying
about his dad. Yeah.
About his dad, after Keating, like, advised him, like, tell your father how you really feel. And you know that this is not a man who makes room for feelings. To go back to the whole gender dynamics issue and toxic masculinity. As opposed to healthy masculinity, I do like to believe that there are beautiful qualities about masculinity. They've been very repressed by our society.
Yes. For me, it's always when he does the, I was good, I was really good, is the first time I start crying, and then I pull it together, and then I always start again when the other boys... Oh god, I'm gonna cry just thinking about it. When the other boys...
I was worried I was going to cry during this recording, actually.
When the other boys go to tell Todd that Neil has died.
Yeah.
And it's that moment, because, like, they're all crying. Like, Charlie's the one who tells him, and he's got tears in his eyes. And then they go outside, and they're just, like, running and screaming. And I don't think there's any birds in that scene, interestingly enough.
No. Well, the birds have all flown south for the winter, because it's the snow at that point. So... there are no more birds.
The moment where I think, again, it's Charlie who's like, let him go. We have to let him go. And they're just all emotional. And it's the same thing. It's not the moment of Neil passing that gets me. It's the aftermath, because they were really... this is not exactly the same vibe as in... Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but the more than a brother, less of a wife. Like, they're really brothers more than friends in this moment. And they have, and I think it just speaks to the whole ensemble of the cast entirely. I think those young actors did a fucking phenomenal job in those roles.
So, Belle.
Yes.
Would you like to tell us about the reviews?
Yes, Margot, I do. yeah, absolutely. So, I have some reviews from the time of its release, and then I have some that are a little more I think just two that are more recent people kind of looking back with nostalgia. And the through lines I really see for all of these reviews, I mean, for the contemporary reviews for when the film was released, are a look at parents in 80s media, which is not a thought, not a way I thought we were going to go. So I'm going to save that towards the end. But what I want to start off with is just the celebration of the ensemble of the film, because it really is an ensemble. It is not like a main character driven thing. It is the story of these boys as a group that I think is really neat. And I think that's how I've always felt. And it's really cool to see that that's how the reception was at the time it aired. You looked like you wanted to say something.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting if you want to talk with the about the ensemble first, and also what you said about 80s media and parents, because that actually brings up another thought that I think may be interesting to keep in the back of our minds while we're discussing this. But, I mean, you mentioned, so the movie was made in 1989, or it came out in 1989, and it was set...
It was set in 1959.
Yeah, so it was released in 1989, and it was set in 1959. And something that I think is really interesting about that is both the 50s and the 80s are decades of American history in which we were very conservative politically. So the 50s become a really good metaphor for what's going on in the country in the 80s. And obviously, so much of this movie, you know, Keating versus the very traditional school is definitely like, you know, liberal versus conservative approaches to ideas, which fits so well, too, with our season motivation of anti-fascism in education. I think this is a really good way of how, like, a really good teacher can create anti-fascist free thinkers, unlike stupid neo-Nazi Cameron in this movie. And then the other interesting thing that I want to say that will bring us back to ensemble casts is there's this really great book called The Baseball Film by Aaron Baker. And in it, I quote this part of this book so much because I think it's just really fascinating. But Baker essentially is arguing that the baseball film really mirrors a lot of very traditional and very conservative American values. And he talks about one movie that he feels really pushed against those values. And that movie was 8 Men Out. And one of the ways in which he says that movie pushed against traditional values is because it's an ensemble cast. And he said an ensemble cast is a democratic use of point of view. And so it really embodies this idea of more liberal thought and democratic thought as opposed to traditional conservative thought. So I think that's a really interesting thing to keep in mind when thinking about this movie, that the ensemble cast promotes more democratic themes in the film. And the interesting thing, too, is Baker argues that 8 Men Out, which, I mean, this would be a fun movie for us to do on this podcast because I believe it was actually not well received by critics.
We could do a whole season of baseball movies, girl.
Oh, we should totally do a whole season of baseball movies. I would love that. So 8 Men Out was not received well by critics. And Baker thinks that part of what really tripped critics up was the ensemble point of view was too hard for them to get. Because it's not like very traditional Hollywood filmmaking. It kind of goes against the corporate Hollywood machine.
What I want to start off with is an article from the Santa Barbara News, or I think it was reprinted from the New York Times, actually. I couldn't seem to find the original, by Bruce Weber. That name sounds familiar. I think we might have read some reviews by him before. I don't know.
That name sounds very familiar.
Right?
Yeah.
Bruce, reach out. Let us know. article by Bruce Weber called Robin Williams, The Comic Versus the Actor. This one I really loved because, well, so he spends the first few paragraphs of the article just describing Robin Williams, like, starting the interview by just kind of taking off on, like, an improv kick and doing a bunch of random bits inspired by, like, the stuff on the table between them, the things he sees out the window, the things that are in the hotel room around them. And So he just starts off by describing, like, so we sit down to do this interview, and we don't do the interview because Robin Williams does the thing that Robin Williams does and does a bunch of random bits that are hilarious.
So, question, was Robin Williams actually also a comedian?
He was a comedian first.
I mean, obviously he's very funny in his movies, but...
He did stand-up first, and then he started his film career. Yes, and we'll talk about some of that as well. And then after he starts describing, you know, what he's doing around the room, he spends a paragraph or so going like, and I have to ask him to stop at some point because we have to do this interview. But how do you tell Robin Williams to stop?
Like, stop him from being Robin Williams.
Right. And like, why would you want to? Because this is like an all access pass, like one person, one audience member show that you're never going to get anywhere else. This is like one of the true delights of the human experience. How could you dare stop that? And what I love about this is that this makes me think of, are you familiar with Inside the Actors Studio, that show?
The name sounds familiar, but I don't think I've ever seen it.
So if you've never seen it, if the listeners have never seen it, I don't think it airs anymore because I'm pretty sure the guy who used to do it died.
Guy who used to do it, if you're still alive, we apologize.
I'm so sorry, yeah. But it was a really interesting format where this guy, a very serious dude, if you've ever seen the meme of the guy with the beard, like the goatee and the eyeglasses in the chair going, improv! It's that guy.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, it's just them on a stage. They are in the actor's studio, which is like an actual like acting school. They would bring in incredible actors to come in the actor's studio and talk. And like he would have a round of questions. At some points they would open to the audience to ask questions. And it's usually pretty subdued and, you know, back and forth and like real conversation-y. But of course it's not with Robin Williams. If I remember correctly, like you can get the full interview some places. It's like 6 hours long when it's not supposed to be that long because it's Robin Williams and he goes off the rails every 10 minutes. My mom loves Inside the Actor's Studio and she loves this particular episode. And I remember her getting her hands on like an extended version of this. And we sat down to watch it. And before we even started, she goes, somebody start a timer because I guarantee you it's going to be at least a few minutes before he sits down in that chair and starts answering questions. And we timed it. And I remember it being like 25 minutes from the time he comes in to like the applause before he sits down and actually starts answering questions. Cause he just starts going off doing bits and it's just being Robin Williams and it's amazing. So I like this interview because I'm like, oh my God, it's like the Inside the Actor's Studio thing. It's so great. And it's so Robin Williams. Anyway, so to get back to the review itself, this author does spend some time talking about his film career and where he's coming from. What I think is interesting about this movie is like, it's not his first movie, but it is early on in his film career. It's only like his eighth movie role. He's really more used to comedy performing. And so I think it's neat that he's coming to it kind of a little green, and the characters who play the students are coming to it kind of green. So it's not only an ensemble, it's sort of an ensemble where we're all a little new to this. And I think that really shows, and that really comes through in the characters, and the characters are designed that way as well, which is neat.
Yeah, these are like actually, I mean, I don't know if they're actually teenage boys because they're like still pimply. Like this is not like them making 30-year-olds play high school students. Like they actually really look like high school students.
I think they're all somewhere in the 18 to 20 range. Mm-hmm. I remember looking it up before. So when this interviewer asked Robin Williams to compare doing comedy and doing like screen acting, he said, performing and acting, one is hang gliding, the other is oil drilling. To describe like how being like just doing that sort of walking into the room and pulling like seven random bits out of the top of his head is like absolutely nothing to him. And the acting is the real interesting challenge. He later goes on to bring up some interesting points. Robin Williams says that what he finds to be the point of Dead Poets Society is trying to find the passionate thing in your life. And then the interviewer follows this kind of reviewing Robin Williams' performance in the movie, saying, quote, his own passion emerges only in snippets. Anyone familiar with the body of his work might regard his performance as constrained. I'd be curious to see what you think about this, because I would agree a little bit. And there's some interesting things other reviewers say about that topic as well that we'll get to in a second. But constrained versus his own, like, weird little Robin Williams passion, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I'm trying to remember being a child and watching a lot of Robin Williams movies, and I do feel like, you know, I mean, Mrs. Doubtfire, the whole conceit kind of allows for mm-hmm. him to be ridiculous, and I don't, is it called Flubber? Flubber?
Flubber! Oh my god, Flubber. I forgot. Flubber, yeah!
That movie is so ridiculous. I feel like there's lots of moments for him to be, like, weird and wacky mm-hmm. in that, too. And I don't feel like that happens as much with this movie. But I also think it works so well for the film because it is about a place that is constraining. And he's trying so hard to break these boys out of the constraints that are set on them.
A little bit of that does come out in some very Robin Williams-esque moments, like when he's talking about, like, Marlon Brando reading Shakespeare or John Wayne doing Shakespeare, and he does slip into, you know, the voices that he can do. It made me think...
His impressions are so good.
They're so
and
good.
Also, the weird bit in the beginning where he tells him to lean in to the old pictures and to hear the ghosts.
Carpe diem.
That felt very Robin Williams.
Yes. Yeah. But I agree. And I think it made me think of some of his work that he did after, like all this movie that I think, where he also is, I don't know if I would call it constrained, but like speaks really to his range. Cause like the movie Awakenings came out like immediately the year after. Have you ever seen that?
Mm-mm. No, I have not. I realize our listeners cannot see me shaking my head.
My roommate, one of my roommates in college, she was a nursing student, and they watched it in one of their classes because it is a medical movie, where he plays a doctor, comes up with this thing where he's like, hey, if we give all these dementia patients this, it might help with some of their symptoms. And then they kind of like, they it's almost like they wake up out of their weird dementia state, and they're like they used to be before. It is a sad movie, spoiler alert. It ultimately turns out that it's a like a waning effect. It doesn't work permanently, and it's not something that could be consistently applied to their situation. But what I think is interesting in both this movie and that movie, and Robin Williams kind of playing a very different role than we might have been used to him doing in the 90s, is that one of these reviews, we'll find it somewhere, I think it's the next one, it talks about, like, he does such a good job, but he's not carrying the movie on his back. It really is about the comedy and the shenanigans that go on around him, and him as, like, a facilitator of that.
And the democratic ensemble.
Yes. Because ultimately, William says, you know, like, the movie is really about the students, quote, it's about what they do when they get this, end quote, which meaning, like, the inspiration from the teacher, which I think could, you know, be said for The Awakenings as well. Oh, yeah, this next one, I think, goes on to the same kind of interesting point. From The Times by Joyce Persico? Persico? I'm not sure how to pronounce your name, Joyce, I'm sorry. Poetic license. Robin Williams gets serious about Dead Poets Society. She comes right out in the very first line saying, quote, a Robin Williams movie that is not really a Robin Williams movie. And I'm so intrigued by that, and I think that's a really weird and also perfect way of defining it.
I think that's also an interesting way of defining it, because even though I had never seen Dead Poets Society until I watched it for this episode, I have always heard about it. And the only thing I knew about it was that it is a Robin Williams movie. And I kind of associate it as being very iconically a Robin Williams movie. And it was not until I saw the credit list today that I even knew Ethan Hawke was in it.
Yeah, absolutely. So what I think this is not necessarily about, I mean, it's a little bit about the reception of the movie after it came out, but this is there's a really interesting look at the goals of, like, the producers and the creators before it came out. So Persico goes on to write that, like, they didn't really have high hopes for this movie's success in this particular summer of releases. So, like, some of the other movies that I read were airing that same summer were more like action or comedy. She writes, titled Dead Poets Society, it possesses neither the title nor the storyline to distract rambunctious viewers whose minds are set on the antics of Indiana Jones, Mr. Spock, or Ghostbusters. A Star Trek movie also came out that summer. Quote, in fact, there probably couldn't be a worse week for so delicate a film to be released, wedged as it is between the super sequels that are drawing viewers to the box office in droves. And then she goes on to say that basically, like, without Williams, this movie might not have been made at all, or might not have gotten the kind of viewership that it did. He really got people's foot in the door. One of the producers, Stephen Haft, and executives at, like, Touchstone all kind of weighed in and were saying that's pretty much exactly what the situation was, thinking that Williams as a name would draw in audience, and that the emotional depth of the rest of the ensemble and the story of the boys would keep them there.
That actually doesn't surprise me, because every time I go on a 1980s movie kick, which does happen periodically, where I just, like...
It's a good era.
Only watch... It's a good era, you know? You go down the Molly Ringwald, Tom Cruise vibe, and every time I watch these movies, I'm like, wow, the 80s were really materialistic.
Yeah!
Because, really, seriously, like, if we just go down a list of, like, movies that came out in the 80s that are still iconic today, think about how much they are ultimately about wealth, success, material forms of doing well in the world. And this movie is not about... This movie is pushing so much against that, because it's about ridiculing these parents and teachers who just want to produce little bankers and lawyers and doctors. And Robin Williams' character is responsible for trying to bring out their poetic, artistic, creative souls. So this movie is really pushing against everything that was popular in that time period that I suspect in the era of Reagan and Reaganomics was probably pretty popular in society in general.
I think that speaks also to some of what we were talking about before about, like, the need for setting this in the 50s. So then Persico goes on to looking at that emotional depth of the students and talking about them as the focus. And describes what I was saying before about how Robin Williams is kind of saying, like, he's not carrying the whole movie through just his own work. That's really different from what he had very recently done previously. His film that came out right before this one was Good Morning Vietnam, which, if you've never seen it, you might know the meme of... If you ever heard anybody do the "Good Morning Vietnam," that's Robin Williams. That's the movie. He's like a radio operator in Vietnam. That's often been cited as like the moment his film career, as opposed to his comic career, really started to blossom. So taking on, he describes like taking on this movie in this interview was not really like a big commercial or financial need or interest for him. He was really fascinated by the idea of not being the center of the film. He said, quote, the pressure would be off, it would be equally shared. And then Persico herself goes on to write, quote, to anyone who has not seen Dead Poets Society, Robin Williams may be the star, but there is an ensemble of young actors who carry the movie, end quote. And then there is another article really does focus on the ensemble aspect we've been talking about, and the title is literally Ensemble Brings Dead Poets to Life. And I think I just have a really long quote, yeah, that I'll read from the article that I thought was really kind of getting at what we're noticing. She writes, despite the presence of Robin Williams in the role of Keating, Dead Poets Society is not a Robin Williams comedy. Quite the opposite. It is an ensemble work featuring a cast of promising young actors who play the characters in serious transition. They are boys in search of separate identities, the sons of wealthy parents who have abandoned them to a school system that has little time for individuality or self-fulfillment. The beauty of director Weir's approach to the story is that he tells it without the usual maudlin aspect that kids at a private school movie can take. scripted by Tom Schulman with a sensitivity for that period in a boy's life when the future could take any direction. The film builds slowly, too slowly in early scenes, to an emotional impact that is quite stirring. Part of that impact is due to the charming nature of Robin Williams' performance in the role of the teacher who instills in his students a sense of rebelliousness. An even larger part is due to the contributions of a sterling cast, of which Robert Sean Leonard, Ethan Hawke, and Josh Charles are standouts. Josh Charles is the one who plays Knox, who we've already discussed is probably our favorite.
He is so cute, ultimately. He makes a big mistake, but he apologizes.
He makes a big mistake.
And he wins the girl.
He acknowledges it was a mistake. He apologizes and does better. And that's all you need to do, folks.
And he does better than the football star boyfriend who wants to literally beat him to death.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not setting the bar high there, but Knox excels.
What I'm interested in this is that she talks about the maudlin aspect that kids at private school movies can take.
What does maudlin mean again?
That's a good question. Let's Google. Define maudlin. Self-pityingly or tearfully sentimental. Often through drunkenness. I mean, I would definitely call this movie sentimental. Funnily enough.
Yeah, but I don't think that's a bad thing. No. I feel like I associate maudlin with negativity.
I think...
What was the quote again that she uses it in?
The beauty of director Weir's approach to the story is that he tells it without the usual maudlin aspect that kids at private schools movies can take.
I also just don't think I can think of enough...
Kids at private school movies. That's what I wanted to bring up. I was like, what are these other movies that she's talking about? I'm not familiar with
them. I mean, the whole time I was watching this, I was like, wow, The Holdovers from a few years ago really owes a lot to this movie.
Oh yeah, you were telling
but
me.
But that did not exist at this time when this review was written.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to do The Holdovers later this season.
Who is in it? You had texted me earlier and now I can't remember who you said.
Paul
Giamatti.
Paul Giamatti.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's really, really well done.
Mm. Okay, so then, you know, I guess kids at a private school movie is a trope that we are not familiar with, but a trope that we have already discussed a little bit, moving into the other theme, is parents in the era of 80s media. Which is not at all a direction it makes perfect sense. And in some of the other media that they talk about in these articles, I'm like, oh my god, yeah, they're so right. But like, I'm floored that I never caught like parents in 80s media as a thing. It's fascinating. This is probably my favorite article title of the whole episode from the Los Angeles Daily News. Yardania Arar titles their article "Parental Avoidance Suggested."
Oh.
So they open the article with, quote, "Can we talk? Not if we're parent and child in some new movies about teenagers, but clearly intended for adult filmgoers as well." And this article really focuses on parent and child relationships during what they call the teen movie explosion of the 1980s. Now, that is a trope I'm definitely familiar with of that era. This is like the John Hughes moment, the Brat Pack.
Molly Ringwald.
Exactly.
I think it's actually really interesting now that you bring this up, because I just listened to... I think You're Wrong About just did an episode with Harmony Colangelo on the invention of the teenager.
Oh, yeah. I need to listen to that.
And it's really good, and I feel really bad if I'm, like, misrepresenting the very well-researched story they tell, but I think that they actually say that it kind of, like... begins with like it's kind of like very much born out of the 50s, which I think is interesting because the movie is
set in the 50s,
but again the 80s also had this really like you know, other explosion of teen moments of teen movies that really defined that era too. So I mean, there's so many fascinating parallels to me about the 50s and the 80s as decades in American culture.
So they talk about the lack of parents or parents as, quote, non-entities in movies like The Breakfast Club, where we see like maybe one or two parents at the beginning of the movie and then obviously never again. Or in Pretty in Pink, where her dad is like there, but like, you know, he doesn't do much. I think it's implied he's like unemployed. He might be sick or something. I'm not entirely sure. Like, he's there in the background, but he's not a focus. And then the rich kids, none of their parents are there. We don't know where Ducky's parents are. The lady in the record shop is more of a parent to her than anybody else in this movie.
Well, that's what I was going to say. In Pretty in Pink, it's been a long time since I saw it, but there's a woman who, like, makes her pink dress for her. Isn't there? Who's not, like, her mother, but is kind of a motherly figure. She had, that woman had this beautiful 1950s
That's
prom dress.
Right, and she wears it at one point in the record shop.
Yeah, she tries it on, but then I think she gifts it to her, and Molly Ringwald recuts it to be more modern and chic, and also makes it just so hideously 80s. Like, it was this beautiful classic 50s dress, and she makes it so hideously 80s.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's fair. So, like, yeah, the only kind of parental entity in that movie is someone who's not actually a parent, but her boss.
And also, to that point, one of my favorite teen movies from this era is Say Anything, because that movie is off the walls insane. Like, it is just such a weird movie. Every time I watch it, I am like, this movie is so weird. But the dad does actually play a huge role in that movie, and he turns out to be a total dick!
Yes! They also talk about Say Anything! So the parents as non-entities like Breakfast Club or Pretty in Pink, hilariously useless parents like Veronica's parents and Heather's that are just kind of, like, there in, like, pretty colors in the background.
What about all the parents in 16 Candles?
Oh my god.
Yeah.
But the article really focuses on parents who were just, like, the bad guys, like, the villains, such as in Say Anything, which also came out in 1989. And I've never actually seen Say Anything. The whole movie was ruined for me by reading the article, so, like, spoilers, whatever, it's fine. I've never seen it, but I guess...
Belle, if you watch this movie, though, it's like, wait, what?
I want to watch it, because I love John Cusack.
Who has, like, no parents in the movie.
Yes. But apparently the bad guy dad is John Mahoney, who I love. I love so much. So I'm curious to see, because he does do a smarmy guy kind of good, like in Moonstruck. This author suggests that there's, like, a similar parent-child communication problem present with Neil in Dead Poets. He can't confront his own father with his ambitions and desires, which the author implies is what really requires the 1950s setting as opposed to the 1989 setting, like we've been talking about as well, as, quote, such conflicts would not seem realistic today, end quote, as in, like, the conflicts that Neil's experiencing with his father would seem less realistic in the 80s.
That being said, though, I also think that if you take all of these kind of rebellious teen movies from the 80s, I bet you could, like, kind of trace them all back to Rebel Without a Cause in the 1950s.
Get the fuck out of here! That's exactly what they do! yeah, absolutely. She goes back to Rebel Without a Cause and another one that I can't remember, but with James Dean. But yeah, no, that's exactly where that comes from. And she kind of ruminates on that a bit, saying, like, maybe this wouldn't be not realistic. Most parents of late 80s teenagers grew up in the freewheeling 1960s or late 50s and should supposedly know better or understand, because, like, they would have been the kids in Rebel Without a Cause. And so just this sort of interesting parallel between the 50s and the 80s we've been talking about, like, other people are noticing this at the time of the movie's release, which I think is super neat. Ultimately, I think what's interesting is that this writer kind of comes to the conclusion that, like, television of this era, as opposed to film, is doing better work depicting, like, the real and painful conversations going on between parents in the relationships, whereas the teen movies kind of leave the parents out.
Do you think the 80s teen movie kind of invented the trope of the parents are gone for the weekend, let's throw a party, that becomes the pivotal plot point?
Yeah, no, I think Risky Business started all of that. I don't think the rager when your parents are out of town, I firmly believe that would not be a thing today if Risky Business hadn't been filmed.
Well, it's funny you bring up Risky Business, because when I talk about the materialism of the 80s, I think Risky Business was the first 80s movie that really made me go, the 80s were really materialistic, and then start thinking about every other 80s movie I had watched, and I'm like, they're all like this, especially when they have Tom Cruise in them.
Rain Man also came out this year in 1989.
I've never seen Rain Man.
It's a good movie. I would also highlight a lot of the materialism you're talking about. Dustin Hoffman, excellent. Always so good. There was another article by Diane Holloway of the Cox News Service that she wrote as a Father's Day special. So also topical, the day of recording this Father's Day is tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Happy Father's Day, Chef Mark.
The title was TV Dad's A Lot Less Goody-Goody.
A lot less goody-goody than?
I don't know. I have some problems with the language in this article, mostly because this writer uses the word daddies.
Okay.
Entirely too much, and it made me gag a little bit every time I read the word.
Oh my god, every time I watch a movie where an adult calls their dad daddy, I'm like, no. No. Also, what does goody-goody mean?
Let's talk about it. So,
okay.
What she does is she compares dads in sitcoms today to those, like, picture-perfect dads from the ones in the 50s and 60s. So, like, her example, and this was really what made me stop and go, what, with this article, was because there's a very big picture of Bill Cosby.
Oh, God.
And so she...
We're not starting off strong.
We're not talking about Bill Cosby the person. She's talking about the TV dad Cliff Huxtable.
Okay.
So she compares, like, sitcom dads in this era in the 80s, like Cliff Huxtable, to those, like, picture-perfect ones from the 50s and 60s, like Ward Cleaver from Leave It to Beaver, who's just, like, the impression I got from her article, it made me think of the weird senator in Parks and Rec that, like, has no personality and they think is a robot who's like, it's a hot one out there today.
Stay cool,
folks, and just sits in his office and says nothing. Because the dads and you know, like the Leave It to Beaver were very, like, not a lot of love, but like a lot of platitudes.
And a lot of ending their sentences with son.
So she takes these, like, TV dads and, like, the weird trend from, like, the picture perfect or the hopelessly, like, silly, useless, and compares them to sitcom dads in the 80s, like the previous article, as, like, having the emotional capacity to have the serious conversations and the time to devote to their kids, and then also compares that to this explosion of teen films in the 80s and the way they portray parents, like a Dead Poets Society. She writes, the new Robin Williams film, Dead Poets Society, I also think it's hilarious that these are all describing it as the Robin Williams movie after we've had that whole discussion about it. The new Robin Williams film, Dead Poets Society, is about an all-boys prep school and also features fathers, most of them bad, and just about all of them in the form of authority figures. But in English teacher John Keating, it has a father figure who, if not perfect and sometimes even culpable, at least tries to instill in his boys something positive, with the passion and confidence to be themselves. He's a worthy role model, like those other father figures, Mr. Chips and Mr. Roberts. These are other father figures from the 80s sitcoms. But he's also a living warning to his boys that sometimes good intentions and high standards don't always work out. So this sort of view on the emotional capacity of parents in the 80s was not a turn. It makes sense given all of the thing going on with dads and parents in this movie, but it was not... Honestly, I did not have a whole lot of faith that it's something that, like, the mass media would pick up on enough to have discussion, like, serious discussions about in newspaper articles, and I'm pretty impressed, actually.
That is really interesting, but, you know, the one thing that I sort of struggle with in that quote is the comment that Keating can be a warning for how good intentions can go astray, because... I don't feel like that's at all a moral of the story. I feel like the moral of the story is about how we kind of live in this oppressive, materialistic society, and sometimes you have to stand up for what you believe in, even if you're going to get kicked down for it.
I think I do agree that there's some moments in the movies where he can serve as like a warning. Like there's a very touching moment after Charlie writes an article for the school paper and authors it by the Dead Poets Society, mm-hmm. suggesting that Welton start admitting girls to the school. And then they, you know, the administration gets all a bit of fuss about it. They have a whole, assembly to discuss it. And Charlie brings a phone into the assembly somehow, I don't know, and makes it ring and answers the phone and says to the dean, "It's God calling. He says we should have girls at Welton." And when the headmaster realizes that this whole orchestration was kind of inspired by Keating encouraging the students to speak up for themselves, he asks Keating to go and talk to Charlie and like calm him down. Mm-hmm. And I do think in that moment he acts as a warning of like, yes, it's important to speak up for yourself, but it's also important to understand the longer game of your life and how these things will have an effect on your future. So I do think there is an argument to say that he can act as a warning, but I agree, it doesn't seem like the warning that this author implies.
Yeah, and I do actually think that's a really good teaching moment where he's teaching the students a boundary there.
Yes.
Like, they took some of his ideals that he's giving them and they sort of misapplied them or irresponsibly applied them. Because I do think whenever you say that the theme of a story is about when to speak up, there's also a phantom parallel theme about when to shut up.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that that's a moment where the boys learn it's not about speaking up always, it's about knowing when to speak up, when to be quiet. And I think that it becomes like a really beautiful parallel for the end of the movie, because like you described in that scene, it's Charlie who does the phone call,
yeah.
Right? Charlie stands up, but I think that that's really interesting because he gets up and I think he stands on the chair, the pew or whatever, to do the whole phone call bit. So it's a really nice parallel
to the kids standing on the desks
at the very end of the movie, where I think we kind of get these dual scenes where we see this was not the moment to do it. This was the moment to do it.
And then the last kind of contemporary to the time review I want to end on is Roger Ebert. And my note is literally just, and then there's Roger Ebert. And like, in a fully derogatory way. Because he did not like this movie. Roger Ebert didn't really sing the praises of the ensemble or like the breakdown of the familiar relations like all the other reviewers were doing. He just really thought the whole thing was pretty pretentious. And so I just have a few select quotes to, he writes, "Dead Poets Society is a collection of pious platitudes masquerading as a courageous stand in favor of something, doing your own thing, I think."
Okay, Roger, I think we can all understand what the moral of the story is. Like, I feel like there's some interesting points there, but, like, don't pretend you don't get the point.
It is, of course, inevitable that the brilliant teacher will eventually be fired from the school, and when his students stood on their desk to protest his dismissal, I was so moved I wanted to throw up.
I think I'm starting to see where A.O. Scott learned how to write film criticism. Continue.
Peter Weir's film makes much noise. Oh, this one really pissed me off because it's about poetry.
Bella is a poet. I think we say that in the intro, but just to remind everybody.
Peter Weir's film makes much noise about poetry, and there are brief quotations from Tennyson, Herrick, and Whitman, and even Vachelinsky, as well as a brave excursion into prose that takes as far as Thoreau's Walden. None of these writers are studied, however, in a spirit that would lend respect to their language. They're simply plundered for slogans to extort the students toward more personal freedom. At the end of a great teacher's course in poetry, the students would love poetry. At the end of this teacher's semester, all they really love is the teacher. And I would again like to bring us to the scene of them exiting the cave, chanting that last line of the poem, and drumming as they're walking through the forest, because they're just so into the vibe of the poetry. Like, at one point, I think what they're, I don't remember the name of the poem, but I'm pretty sure it's like a beatnik poem, which would have been just at the beginning of this era. So like they're even getting into new poetry and living poets. Mm-hmm. Like these boys really liked poetry at the in this movie. And I'm so hurt. And like, yes, of course, we like to plunder slogans to extort ourselves toward more personal freedom in poetry, because that's what it's about.
Well, I agree with you. That's what it's about. I also have to say, like, this is a movie. Its job is to entertain. It's not literature 101 at a college university. Like,
I think it would have been, I think I would have enjoyed the movie if it was really that deeply about poetry. I don't think anybody else would have.
I think I would have, too. I don't think it would have had commercial appeal at that point.
No, even with Robin Williams.
But also to your point about what poetry is really about, I remember, God, I wish I could remember where I heard this story, but I must have been at, like, an NYU lecture I went to years ago that was about the idea of recitation, like, as in reciting things from memory, and about how that used to be what schools were all about, right? Like, you would recite the poem.
Like the Latin class.
Yeah, or probably even...
where they're just literally reciting conjugations of verbs.
Exactly. But that was also English class. You would get up and you would recite the poem from memory. Instead, these boys get up and recite their own poetry that they wrote, and it's about instilling a sense of creativity and their own power to create. But the other thing that I would say, you know, in terms of the whole, like, plundering the poems for slogans, is I heard this great story once about this woman who grew up, this older woman who had grown up in the days of reciting poetry for English class. And there was a poem that was really meaningful to her that had stuck with her whole life. Like, she could still recite the whole thing, even as, like, an old woman. And she talks about how, like, when really bad things happened to her, she could recite this poem and derive comfort from it. It's almost like a prayer, a meditation. So I don't think it's plundering poetry for slogans. I think it's having these words in your heart that get you through hard moments. And there's also that famous, I don't remember if he's Scottish or British, but one of the famous 19th century poets, like one of the Yeats or the Keats or the something like that, was very sick his whole life and in and out of hospitals, like having very intense surgeries and stuff like that. And he would compose poetry while he was sick in the hospital. And so, like, a lot of his poetry was about these slogans, air quotes, that got him through all of these medical issues. Anyway, that's what I have to say about that.
I agree with you wholeheartedly on all of those things. So, on to the IMDb review titles, which are my favorite part. There's not a lot that are, like, really atrocious, but there are some that I think really get at the heart of the matter. A masterful tribute to teaching at its best.
Agreed.
I always say when I rewatch this movie, it kind of romanticizes and makes me fall back in love with the idea of being a teacher. And then I actually think about going back to teaching and I'm like, dear God, no. This movie is the greatest movie.
Oh, okay. Period.
It is a cynical, dull, very methodical, and slow in development. And yet it has grown on me to where it is one of my favorites.
I think that was title. A cynical, dull, slow to develop criticism.
Yeah. And then my favorite one, the 9 out of 10 movie I'll never watch again.
Huh.
And then they go on in the review to explain it was, like, way too emotional and they cry too much. And so they're like, I can never watch this again because it was too good and it was too much.
There are definitely movies I watch where I'm like, that was very well done, but I never want to see that again in my life. I actually could imagine watching this again because it is so inspiring at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very romantic in the lowercase and capital R setting.
It's tragic in the Aristotelian cathartic way.
Ooh.
Not in the, like, contemporary prone to depression way.
I think that is a great time to transition into some tarot cards.
Oh, tarot.
All right. So the characters I've chosen for cards are, I'm just going to go with Todd and Neil, because we've said a lot that this is really an ensemble, but I think if you had to pick main characters or like the characters through which the heart of the story is focalized, I would pick Todd and Neil, really, as opposed to Keating. For both of them, I've selected some wands because they are the suit of passion and creativity, which seems very fitting. I suppose if I had to pick one for Keating, I'd probably give him King of Wands, but I'm not going to go further into that because I didn't really plan to. But anyway, so for Todd, I've selected the Page of Wands. You know, a page is sort of like an apprentice kind of character. They're youthful, a little bit naive maybe, but ultimately they're like ripe for learning and trying. They are like often depicted as like stepping into a new scene or a different space on a card. A lot of times the Fool in the tarot is also thought to technically be a page, because in the classic Rider-Waite-Smith deck, they are illustrated very much the same, and the Fool is about to like step off the edge of a cliff. So the pages are people that are like, you know, especially Page of Wands, I've described it as a creative spirit that's at the very start of its journey. And I think that fits really well for Todd, because even though to get him to eventually like say the poem in front of the class, it ends up being a very spontaneous spur of the moment, whatever comes to his mind thing that Keating kind of pulls out of him in this exercise. But we do see him trying to write poems in other parts of the movie, and he does ultimately get to say what I think he's been trying to say through his drafting exercises, because in the little bits that you can kind of see of his paper, he does talk a lot about truth. And that is ultimately what his poem ends up being about. Truth is a blanket that doesn't cover your feet, or whatever the metaphor is. I love that whole poem. Every time at the end of it, I go, God damn, I wish I could write like that. And I understand that like Ethan Hawke didn't write that poem. And then for Neil, I've also selected the Wands. But for him, I selected the Four of Wands, which if you are familiar with tarot, the picture usually on this card is of people kind of like almost dancing around a sort of maypole situation in celebration, because Neil I see as also a very ripe creative spirit, but whereas I don't see Todd as like solitary, but he is very much like setting out on his own journey. I hesitate to say by himself because that feels negative, but like alone, but in a good way. I don't have a word for that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I also like bringing up the, I feel like the imagery you use there too kind of evokes that very like midsummery imagery.
Yes. It looks like if you pull that card, it looks like you could have pulled it straight out of a scene of A Midsummer Night's Dream. Mm-hmm. Neil's also a creative spirit, just kind of getting started, but his experience is deeply rooted, I think, in community and friendship and support systems. He understands and values and appreciates the importance of having good people around him, which is, I think, why the conflict with his father hurts so much and does as much damage as it does. Because when you look at the support system he should have in his family and compare it to the support system he does have in the other boys at school, it's vastly different. So for Todd, I see it again, not a solo journey, but not in a bad way, just as in like he's embarking on this new thing and he has to take some time to learn and understand it himself, because that's just the kind of person he is. Whereas Neil is all about dancing around in the woods with your friends.
Yes, totally.
Just like Puck.
Yes.
So what are your final thoughts? Tell me some things.
I don't have any poems memorized by heart. But there is a poem, so one of my favorite poets, I know this is very cliche, is Emily Dickinson, because I read her poems and they're...
She's a boss! It's not cliche at all!
They're so good! Like, I could just read pages and pages of her poems, but I like, one of them that I really love is the one that begins, "Safe in Their Alabaster Chambers." And I remember, like, I brought this up to a friend of mine who is also a poet, like a year ago, and I mentioned that poem and he just like whipped it out and like had it memorized. He's a really big Dickinson fan, so I really appreciate that, but I thought maybe I would read my Emily Dickinson poem.
Please do. Okay.
So, "Safe in Their Alabaster Chambers, untouched by morning and untouched by noon, sleep the meek members of the resurrection. Rafter of satin and roof of stone, grand go the years in the crescent above them. Worlds scoop their arcs and firmaments row, diadems drop and doges surrender, soundless as dots on a disk of snow.
Oh,
I know, right? And also, just to be clear for everybody who doesn't know, a doge was the person who ran Venice when it was, like, a monarchy. It's not he who shall not be named department. Though yeah. I do find it very poetic that that department,
yeah.
That acronym happens to be, like, the guy who was, like, the grand dick of Venice. So, and I meant Dick, not Duke.
I guess I'm aware.
Okay.
Poetry's so good.
Poetry's so good.
Thank you, Keating, for helping us to remember that. So, this movie always just makes me fall in love with the idea of being a student, with, like, being in college, being a literature student, being a poetry writer, and just a little bit with being a teacher. Just a little bit, though.
Well, is that a wrap?
I believe it is. All it's right. Just, you know, a nice movie about writers and poetry and sucking the marrow out of life.
All right, well. Oh, Captain, my Captain. Thank you.
Thank you. You can find your Silver Nitrate Witches on various online platforms at LJ Valenza and at Bellang303. Thanks to Fine Motor for the use of their songs Highway Moon and In Event. You can check out more about the band at finemotormusic.com. Thanks for listening. Stay witchy and keep watching movies.